This episode is brought to you by the Grace Enough podcast, where host Amber Cullum and her guests delve into hard truths and the unwavering grace of God while journeying in the kingdom of God here on earth. Listen every week at graceenoughpodcast.com or on your favorite listening app.
Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture. Brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table. We discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director for Cultural Engagement at the Hendrick Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. And we're taking a look at the arts today, and we have a very special guest, Andrew Peterson, who is an author, a host of a chat among artists, a musician. I mean, there's almost no part of the arts that you don't touch. I hear that you're on the edge of filmmaking now, so you're just going in all directions.
I'm pretty tired.
Well, we're welcome. You could stop by and get a little rest here with us.
Glad you.
And then Glenn Kreider, who teaches systematic theology here at Dallas, who's a long veteran of table foreign wars, as we call it. He's been done several podcasts now. But you're really excited about this one, aren't you?
I'm very excited.
Yeah.
Just to be across the table from my friend. I'm excited.
So Andrew, our topic's the arts and thinking through the arts and helping Christians think through the arts and kind of the arts experience, kind of all that. So how did you discover you were an artist, or did you just fall into it? How did you end up doing what you're doing?
Well, it's there's about 10 long versions of that story. I think the best way to put it would be that I grew up in the church mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not mostly, completely in the church. I don't know why I said mostly even. My dad's a pastor, was a pastor until last year. He just retired after 50 years.
Mm.
So I grew up in the South in a small town, one of four kids, and I was the only musician in the family.
Mm.
Or the only one really drawn to music.
Mm-hmm.
My brother and I both loved to listen to music, but I was the one who wanted to make it. It wasn't enough to like just hear it. I wanted to find out what it was like to get inside a song, you know. And I think my brother was a huge influence. He was the one who, when I was reading, you know, pulp fantasy novels, he was the one saying, "What are you doing reading that stuff? Read The Lord of the Rings," you know, and just always kind of raising the bar and pushing me to consider better writing than I tended to when I was a kid. And so I don't know. I just, in the culture that I grew up in, a lot of the people were farmers, and FFA was big in my town. All my buddies had four wheelers, and I would go help them feed calves after school. And I just I appreciate that now. At the time, I didn't appreciate it, but I just couldn't wait to get out of there. And all I wanted was to go to a place where other people liked music the way that I did. I wanted to be around people who seemed to like hunger for what art did to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have, other than my brother, there weren't very many people in this little town that did it. So I always just felt like a weirdo,
mm-hmm.
I think, growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only left-handed person in my family, too. And I love to draw, I love to do music. But so there was something about the making of things that got my attention early on.
So it's the creativity of it, you think, that caught your attention, or
it was the mystery of it that caught my attention. It was the fact that that certain kinds of movies or certain kind of books or music did something that I couldn't articulate to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was Pink Floyd was one of my favorite bands when I was a kid. And, you know, it's pretty trippy music.
Mm-hmm.
And I would lay on my bed with the little box speaker on either side of my head and with my eyes closed and just lose myself in this music. Like there was just something about it that I was always, I had had these flashes of, you know, I think what C.S. Lewis called Sehnsucht, you know, that that idea that those flashes of almost painful longing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always trying to find more of them, you know what I mean? And so whether it was a book or a movie or a song, whatever it was. And then I began to had a few moments like that in the making of something, you know. And this was all pretty, it was divorced from my faith as I knew it at the time. Like it was, I think I always believed in God, but I also didn't see, there wasn't a context in which I could flourish as an artist in the church. Mm-hmm. Like that stuff was seen as kind of like a waste of time. You know, it wasn't like my parents were mean about it. It just, yeah. nobody had...
It didn't fit.
Well, yeah, there was not a paradigm for it where we lived. So I, it just took a long, it was just a lot of following clues.
And so you learned to play instruments?
Did I?
You took lessons?
I learned from, I played piano a fair bit, journey songs mostly when I was in high school, so that at church camp I could impress girls. Mm-hmm. That was the whole thing. It was like, I've just got to learn how to do this stuff because...
There are always girls in this church.
I'm glad, glad to hear that. But no, there's a lot of musicians out there came by it honest because they were trying to impress a girl. Uh-huh. And so at church camp, I remember sitting at the piano. I learned Richard Marx stuff and journey, and I'd worked on it all summer so that that week at camp I could have something because I couldn't play sports very well and I was whatever, but and sure enough it worked. I was sitting there in the gym where the old out of tune piano was and I was playing these journey songs and the girls sure enough gathered around the piano and I was like, it's working. And then on the other side of the gym a guy pulls a guitar out of the case and they all followed him out into the baseball field and I was like, I couldn't move the piano.
So loser.
His name's CJ. And he ended up being the guy I went to Bible college with and taught me to play guitar. The first song I ever learned was a Guns N' Roses song on the, so that I could play with him out in the baseball field. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So it, I won't, there's all kinds of theology we can keep in that, but I don't think I want to go there. So now talk about what you do. I mean, you are multifaceted. You, you've got this Wing Feather Saga, which I take it is written for young people, basically, or is it primarily, or is it... Or do you see it as kind of spanning the globe?
Well, I mean, the idea, like, I think anybody who writes for young people would hope that grown-ups would read their stuff, too. And so I think about it like Harry Potter or Narnia. It's like, sure, it's good for kids, but I would hope that the parents would enjoy it.
Yeah, I tell my wife, she says, is teaching adults different than teaching children? And I go, no.
And so, except adults are easier.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, sometimes.
My friend Jason Gray. Do you know Jason? Mm-hmm. He's a songwriter, and every summer he goes and teaches at a church camp for kids. And he said that it's such a good thing for him to have to remember to have to relearn how to explain the gospel to children.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's really easy to get lost in this heady stuff.
That's true.
And when you boil it all down, it's like, this is difficult. It's like writing poetry.
Yeah.
It's like whittling it down to its essence is a good discipline.
Yeah, in fact, some people say that if you can't do that, then you really don't get it yet. It's an interesting challenge. But you also host the Rabbit Room. Now, the name itself sounds intriguing, and on your website you've got this picture of this scene in a British pub. And so that's interesting. So what is the Rabbit Room?
So the Rabbit Room is it's we're still learning how to explain it in a sentence or two. I can tell you the mission statement for the Rabbit Room. The Rabbit Room exists to foster spiritual formation and Christ-centered community through story, art, and music. And so the idea struck pretty organically, but the moment that really where the light bulb turned on was in Oxford at the Eagle and Child, where Lewis and Tolkien and their buddies would sometimes hang out. And I'm an American, so of course I've got to go see this place when I'm there.
Right.
And the funny thing about the Eagle and Child pub is that it's full of Americans who are C.S. Lewis fans. That's
right. Like,
the British people don't do this anymore.
Don't care, And so anyway, but I noticed that in that first visit that there was a little piece of paper tacked to the awning or the gable going into that back room that said the Rabbit Room. And I'd never heard that before. I'd read a lot of books about C.S. Lewis, and everybody knew about The Eagle and Child, but not about that. So I asked the bartender, I was like, hey, what does this mean? And he said, oh, I think they kept rabbits in that room in the 1600s. No joke. And it got that nickname. So the point is, I was thinking about the Inklings and that friendship. That it's easy to romanticize it and be like, oh, those guys, all these dons sitting there puffing their pipes and talking big ideas. But really, I think they were just friends.
Yeah.
They were just buddies. It was almost like the books were an excuse to just be together.
Right.
And that friendship You know, C.S. Lewis said in back of one of his books that his favorite sound in the world is the sound of men laughing, and that's one of my favorites too. So I get the picture in my mind of these guys just kind of using books almost as like just a kind of like the garden where their friendship was growing. And so I thought about Nashville, and one of the great blessings of living in Nashville is that there are so many people who take their craft seriously.
Absolutely, yeah.
But who are also true believers, you know, people who really see it through the lens of the gospel. And I realized that I was a beneficiary, is that the right word?
Yeah.
Not benefactor, beneficiary of those friendships. That the work that I was trying to do was greatly nourished by my friendships with other people who cared about those things. And so I was like, well, there's some synergy between what those guys happened upon and Nashville. So the Rabbit Room was kind of an experiment in saying, what would it look like if we tried to emulate some of the Inklings stuff only in this town full of music instead of a town full of Oxford Dons?
Yeah, Nashville's a pretty interesting place. My daughter has lived in Nolensville for over a decade, and we're out there periodically. She's getting ready to move to Indianapolis. But the amount of musical talent, even in the churches, I mean, you go in the churches and you hear some pretty fantastic music and the worship and that kind of thing. And it's always struck me, it's the only airport I go to where the little diner in the airport has live music going on at the same time.
And good live music. It's like the guys that are playing in those little dive bars are actually amazing.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah. So it's an interesting opportunity. Well, Glenn, let's talk a little bit. I do have one question for you, and that is, you know, we talked about how art struggled to fit in the context of the church, and yet the idea of truth and beauty is a pretty important idea in theology. So you're the theologian amongst us. Help us with that. Why? I guess two questions. How should we think about truth and beauty? And secondly, why do you think it is that art struggles to kind of find its place in the church?
Truth and beauty are often separated. It's like truth and love or mercy and truth. And in the Christian circles, particularly in evangelicalism, truth is often limited to propositional statements. So we talk about this story being true, or this story, which actually is a made-up story, is true in a different way in which the story of the resurrection is true. Then we move into poetry and wisdom sayings, and they are true in a different sense. That both truth and beauty, it seems to me, and I'm interested in your take on this, truth and beauty have to be understood in relationship to the God who is, and the Son who is the incarnation of both truth and beauty. And that music has a way, the arts have a way of expressing in an experiential, they create an experience that connects with people. I love the language of mystery. That somehow in this experience of beauty and truth, in a way that sometimes is difficult to put into words, one experiences the presence of God and the experiences the gospel. I mean, there's something about live music. This music does that for me anyhow, but there's something about live music that is that's an amazing, amazing experience of truth and beauty, that and the beautiful doesn't necessarily have to. I mean, there's a sense in which even that which is not beautiful, as it draws us towards the beautiful, as
tragedy,
as it describes the world that is and the longing for the world to come. This how our lives are shaped by it, how arts help us to shape us by the future which is to come, which is one of the real major themes in your writing, both both music, lyrics, and fantasy novels. This hope of the world that is to come. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about.
Yeah, I noticed that about five albums in. that there's like a, I don't know, you guys are smarter than me. But there was like an eschatology to a lot of the songs. There was like I tended to focus on heaven, and I can trace how the I read N.T. Wright's Surprised by Hope several years ago, and I can see the change in the way I thought about heaven bear itself out in the songs, and like the longing became even more focused and pointed the more I began to kind of understand the biblical picture of what's coming, you know. And so that and, you know, going back to when you're asking about me as a kid, is like that longing, that what is it? Well, like, there's something tugging at my heart to something. It's always pulling me towards something, someone, but there was always like a, it felt like a destination to me. And, and so, yeah, I don't know. That's always come up in my songwriting and in the book writing too. And I think that at least for the art that has moved me, I don't know if this is true of all art, but I think one of the great things that it does is it builds these signposts to the kingdom. Hmm. And, you know, it's like C.S. Lewis. Do you remember the C.S. Lewis illustration of the man in the shed or whatever? Have you heard? There's like, he uses a great illustration of a beam of light that's kind of, you're standing in a shed, dusty shed, and there's a crack in the ceiling, and there's a beam of light coming through, and you can look at the light, and you can be like, wow, that light, look at that beam of light. But something else happens entirely when you stand in the light, and you look through the crack, and you see the trees outside of the shed. And I think that's the kind of art that Christian art can do that. It doesn't always do that, but it can do that. I think it's one of the highest calls.
Almost point beyond itself in some way.
Yeah, the thing is beautiful, but then the goal is to move people into the light, not just to admire it, but to move into it so that you can see what's on the outside.
Yeah.
It's that crack where the light shines through in Leonard Cohen's work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, interesting, because I do think the term mystery is an interesting one, because it's almost, there are some things that happen with art that are beyond words, you know. You can't express it, but you know it's there, and you feel it. There are times sometimes when I see a movie, or it tends to happen to me in movies, less with music, but where I see a movie and there's a particularly poignant moment, and all of a sudden I feel this well of emotion watching it and going, and I don't even know where it comes from. It just boom, you know, and it's on you. And then it leads to a kind of reflection that is healthy. And so I think we underestimate this. So we deal with the second half of the question, and then I kind of want to ask you about kind of the seasons of your writing. But the second half of the question, why is it that you think we struggle with the placement of art? Is it because we have been captured so much by expression and word and the way we conceive of truth that we've almost limited its ability to get at us other ways?
I think we have a hierarchical view that says the most important thing is the words, which makes music difficult for us to understand and embrace, because music is not lyrical, and it changes everything when the music changes. I mean, Andrew's killed a couple of his songs for me when he re-recorded them recently for that best of. It doesn't sound the same. No More Faith doesn't sound the way it's supposed to sound. That one, I went back to playing the old one in class. I think it also is because of the mystery, because of we can control words, but music and the arts are so mysterious. And I think that there's also, we are aware of the power of the arts to grip people's emotions, to lead them. And some people would hear your story about a movie and be deeply troubled by that. So, but you're watching the movie theologically informed, that if we have done a good job of not separating things that ought to be together, and that people are thinking theologically, they're feeling theologically, they're experiencing theologically, that they're not bifurcating these ideas and these tasks into, which is part of why, so we do that with the arts too. We have Christian arts and secular arts, and it has nothing to do with, it should have nothing to do with quality. It usually has to do with content. And we're back to verbal content instead of pursuing truth and beauty.
So I wanted to ask you, Andrew, about your, whether you feel like your writing has moved at all in terms of through the seasons of life. You've already alluded to this a little bit, that you feel like you're writing with a more conscious awareness of how you address issues of hope and direction. But Are there other moves that you see in your writing that are impacted by, or am I overanalyzing what happens? You know,
no, there's certainly growth that happens. Mm-hmm. There's a, hopefully, anyway, there are some songs that people request that I won't play now because I just can't stomach it anymore. Because what I hear, because you know, if you write the kind of songs I write, then it tends to be a documentation of where my heart was 20 years ago or whatever. And there's some things that I just don't let. There's a song called The Chasing Song, which was on my first record. And it's a song about selfishness, you know, and whatever. It's clever. And which that's, by the way, David Wilcox, who's one of the great songwriters ever. Like, I remember hearing him talk about how when he listens to his young songs, he hears himself trying to be clever. And I was like, what's wrong with being clever?
Yeah.
And now I see it as like, the last thing you want to do is draw attention to yourself and not the thing that you're pointing to.
Yeah.
And so sometimes that cleverness can be a hurdle. So this is one of those songs. And it was so, what I hear is a kid who was, grew up fairly legalistic and was in Bible college and was pretty self-righteous and was really, really good at beating himself up. That's what I hear when I hear that song. And it is almost not at all about the grace of God or the Christ's work on the cross or anything like that. So when I hear it, I'm like, I just don't, not only do I not feel that, but I would rather sing about the other side of that coin to people. And so when people request it, I've got to go, do I explain all that? Or do I just say no? I don't know. So but there are some songs. I get one of the great blessings. And my dad, like I said, is a pastor. Remember hearing him talk about this, that one of the great blessings of working at the same church for a really long time is that you, you know, you actually get to see some of the fruit of your ministry.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? You get to marry people that you were there for their birth, you know, that kind of thing. And so as a musician, you know, I've been at this for about 20 years now, and I've been able to document, like I said, this different stages of my life. So one of the cool things that happens at concerts is that the people that are about my age will come up and say, you know, I'm writing about the stuff that they're that is right around the corner from them as parents or as married people. Or, you know, like I just, last two albums of mine were more or less about a midlife crisis. And, you know, I didn't want the albums to be about that. That was just what the Lord was doing in me. And so it's been so interesting to meet all these guys at shows that are like, man, I'm 39. I really needed that last record, you know? And so it's been one of the fun things is being at this long enough to have seen, you know, slight changes in like the way I write songs, but really it's there's a consistency to just trying to be faithful to exactly where God has me. It's like every part of our story is interesting if you look closely enough at it.
But you know, I do think it's interesting how art just kind of takes us, has the capability of taking us to places that otherwise we might not even go.
This episode is brought to you by the Grace Enough podcast. I am its host, Amber Cullum. Each week, I sit down with a guest to discuss hard truths and the unwavering grace of God they've experienced while journeying in God's kingdom here on earth. You'll hear from guests like Jen Wilkin, Jamie Ivey, Andy Crouch, and Scott McKnight. Listen to these conversations and more by searching Grace Enough Podcast on your favorite listening app or by visiting graceenoughpodcast.com.
You put Christian and art together, and some people say, it really isn't Christian until you're really explicit about what you're doing. And then other people say,
because Jesus was always so explicit.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's right. He talked in very precise theological and never used a parable. No. And then other people say, no, art and drawing people in, sometimes some of the beauty of it is the mystery and the subtlety of it. So that's an open-ended question, kind of where.
Well, I think a lot of it's easy to get lazy about how we experience art. There's a lot of stuff that people may think, oh, well, that's kind of highfalutin, whatever, I'm just like a normal guy. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to be like, actually, no, you're pretty smart. Mm-hmm. And if you just kind of gave it a little bit of time, it would open itself up to you in a really rich and beautiful way. And so so I think that's part of it, is that I think that people are intimidated by this idea that, you know, something that isn't explicit, that you've got to really dwell with.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid maybe that they aren't going to get it and what that might suggest about themselves. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of... We can slip into that, especially in our culture. There's so many movies that are, you know, tremendously moving. If you kind of, like you were talking about, with develop an ability to see things or think about things theologically, you can experience things differently. I remember watching the movie Hellboy. Did you ever see that movie?
No, I didn't.
So Hellboy is this comic character, and I haven't talked about this in a long time. I wonder if I should even spend any time on it. But he's a comic character who was a demon or whatever that ended up being raised by a priest, right? A portal opens and this baby demon ends up in our world. This is comic book stuff. So
yeah,
you gotta, and he's raised by a priest, and the priest gives him a new name.
Hmm.
And tells him, you have a different name than whatever. And the whole story in Hellboy is of this like big bad demon trying to tell Hellboy, you are not who your father is. You are who I say you are.
Hmm.
And as soon as he, like the big climactic moment in the movie is when he literally breaks his own demon horns and claims the name that his priest father gave him.
Hmm.
And I remember just sitting in the theater weeping, because that whole name idea is one of the ones that I've struggled with the most. I'm very susceptible to the enemy's attacks in that way. Like I believe lies about myself all the time. And so it profoundly affected me. And the guy I was sitting with, I was like, oh my goodness, did you notice all the whatever? And he was like, what are you talking about? It was just a cool monster.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So I think, and I just think that's part of, because of my job, I've gotten into the habit of looking for the metaphor, looking for how is the Lord speaking now? You know? And, you know, I don't know if you've heard, I don't know who said it, if this is just an old saying, people say there's two books of Revelation, there's scripture and there's nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a hobby gardener and beekeeper at home, all of that stuff is metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
It's like God is using metaphor constantly through creation.
Well, he started us off
himself.
In a garden.
Yeah.
You know, and we're supposed to tend the garden and manage it well, and as a way of talking about stewardship. So that shouldn't be too surprising.
Right.
How we didn't raise this earlier. Maybe it's a good time to talk about it now. Talk a little bit about your family and how I was talking about the seasons of life. And I guess one of the things I had in the back of my mind in asking that question is as you move through, you talked about early on writing, thinking about, well, some of the stuff that I write I don't like as much anymore because I was just being clever or felt like I was just being clever. How much does the presence of your family and the way you interact with your family impact your art? Or
oh man, I don't even know how to talk about that. They're kind of at the heart of it. And they've always been at the heart of it. Like the reason I do music is because my wife talked me into it.
Mm.
She's pretty, so I tend to, I'm a pushover.
Yeah.
And so, no, she has always seen something in me that, she doesn't even really like music all that much is the irony.
Huh.
But she has always loved me. And she saw some gift or some desire that I had to try to do music. And so she fanned the flame. And you know, I would rather be home than on stage any day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the culture of our family. Like we take the call very seriously, the vocational spiritual call to use my gift and just try to steward it for God's kingdom. Does not mean that it's always fun for me to be gone.
Well, you even talk about that on your webpage. I mean, I saw that on your webpage that you were talking about the traveling does get old. You do miss your family, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so they are, I don't want to say they're my muse. That isn't exactly what I mean. But they are the thing that the truest part of my life, I think, is the way God has opened up the gospel to me through my wife and my children.
Now, Glenn, you had some questions you wanted to ask Andrews about craft. Let's talk about that.
And then your kids are musicians too.
Yeah. Which is a blast. So I've been married 22 years. My oldest is 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then a 17-year-old and then a 14-year-old girl, and all of them play music. And we've done a few family band tours around Europe even. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the greatest feelings in the world to turn around and see my children using their gifts, mm-hmm. Not just for the kingdom, but for their dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, holy cow, I can't believe that they're cool enough to want to hang out with me right now.
Yeah,
and I don't have to pay them. It's wonderful.
Yeah. For their dad, but also typologically for their Heavenly Father.
Yeah, yeah.
Once
yeah,
again, it's true. It all comes together. So I don't write much poetry. Had to dabble a little bit in songwriting, and it's a completely different animal from the kind of writing that I do. So you're a songwriter, lyricist, and a fiction novelist. Those are two radically different genres.
Yeah.
So I've had songwriters say to me, who are students at the seminary, so you ask for a 10-page paper. I've spent all my life boiling my thoughts down to a phrase. I write a page and a half. I got nothing. That's it. somewhere in there is a question about the craft of writing.
Yeah. Well, I think I hear exactly what you're saying, is that poetry and songwriting, which are very, very different, but they are about a lot of distilling, a mm-hmm. lot of like whittling down. And that happens in novel writing too, but in a much less dramatic way, mm-hmm. I think. The way I've described it in the past is that songwriting tends to be about patience. Mm-hmm. Novel writing is about endurance. Mm-hmm. And so one is a sprint and one is a marathon. Mm-hmm. And so there's a, like with songwriting, I remember Rich Mullins saying one time that songwriting was like going fishing. You get all your stuff ready, you go and you sit by the pond, and you kind of wait. There's a lot of waiting that happens, and because you do need some flash of an idea, or you need to happen upon something that opens the door to the song or whatever it is. And so countless nights of me sitting up with my guitar falling asleep because I just cannot think of an idea. But when you're writing a story, you just kind of meander. Mm-hmm. You just are like, it doesn't have to be good. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you're just writing sentences.
Get something down on the paper.
Building paragraphs and going, well, maybe this happens and maybe that doesn't happen. And then the editing process is the really fun part of like taking this lump of clay and turning it into a piece of pottery. Mm-hmm. But it's like 2,000 words a day. That was my thing. I was like, I would get up in the morning, go to Starbucks, and not let myself go home until I'd written 2,000 words. Mm-hmm. And in that way, writing a book is just math, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if I'm truly committed to writing 2,000 mm-hmm. words a day, it'll take me 3 months to write the first draft, mm-hmm. you know?
You told me one time in the midst of that you hadn't written a song for a while.
Yeah.
So how do you get back into writing songs?
With a lot of fear and failure. Songwriting, man, is just so hard for me. And it's getting harder the older I get. I don't know what exactly it is about it, but like, it's kind of like blogging. I don't know if you ever tried blogging.
Yes.
But in the beginning, it was like, this is a blast.
Yeah, yeah.
And now when I think about writing a blog post, I'm like, because I think I've grown as a writer, I'm a lot more picky than I was before. And I'll be like, actually, that wouldn't make a good post. Like, what do I? So I tend to write those a lot less. So I think the songs are the same way that like, and, you know, I'm not saying that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I think that if I were more kind of youthful and spry, I would just write a bunch of bad stuff and find something good. Mm-hmm. But now if I don't feel it, then I abandon it, or I put it aside and work on something else. Mm-hmm.
So which comes first, the music or the...
That's exactly my question.
That is the age-old question.
Yeah.
It happens different every time. There's no consistent thing. Anyway, I usually say that if somebody tells you they know exactly how to write a song, they're either a bad songwriter or a liar. And so anytime you engage in the creative act, you are entering into mystery of some kind. Like, we are, like, it's an embodiment of one of the core elements of our, who we are as image bearers of a creative God. And so who are we to think that we know how that works? Mm-hmm. Other than you do the work and you're present and you are curious and you try to maintain a sense of wonder, but always a sense of humility, because what you're entering into is something that you don't understand. Mm-hmm. And so when I teach writing workshoppy stuff, you know, sometimes I'll go and teach, and I usually try to, it's not about nitpicking lyrics or choruses or whatever. It's about how to cultivate a writing life, how to learn how to be discerning artistically, learn how to, because I feel like that's whether or not the songs are good, I think God is not nearly as interested in the songs we're writing as he is in who he's shaping us to be. Well, we are the song that is being written. And so that's the thing that I like thinking about the most, is that Once again, it's a metaphor that's playing out. It's like I'm hacking away at this thing in order to make something beautiful.
So sometimes you've got a tune, and sometimes you've got lyrics and that need a tune.
Is that, yeah, is that thank you for bringing us back to the original question. that's very subtle of you. So no, I think it works best when they both are born at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Like if I write some lyrical passage that I think is really good, and then I later try to put music to it, I feel like I can always hear that that's how it happened. But if it, like, ideally the way it works is not to this may be too specific, but you're sitting there playing the guitar and you get a rhythm and then you start mumbling things and a phrase comes out of the mumble that you latch onto because it's interesting, and then you try to find out why where the mumble came from, why that phrase, and you chase it down that way. The thing that you blurted out came out so naturally and organically that it kind of has to exist
with
that
music.
Guitar riff or that piano part. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And, you know, the best songs, you can hear that happening. It's like there's a rhythm to them and a syncopation to it, and the lyric just, like, sits in the bed of music perfectly. And I'm like, oh, you can tell that that happened at once, you know?
But it's different than writing with people, writing with somebody else.
Yeah, I don't do that. I'm too scared to do that. Cindy Morgan is this wonderful, wonderful songwriter. I just did a show with her a few days ago, and she co-writes constantly. Like a lot of guys in Nashville go from studio to studio all week long and love it. So much so that they kind of can't do it unless they're co-writing. They just enjoy it so much. And I just have this, I'm too much of a chicken. I just sit in the room and have zero, it's like static on a TV. They're like, what do you think about that? And I can go home and work on something somebody gives me, but
what's the live experience like? So for me, I prepare to teach, I walk into the classroom, and something happens, the Spirit of God is present in the community. You have that same kind of experience, and
I mean,
you rewrite songs in a live performance.
No, but I change the set list every time. I mean, there's very seldom do I do the exact same songs every night, because I try to be sensitive to the spirit or to the vibe of the room or whatever. The live thing is my favorite thing to do. Like, I love to write books, I love music, but when I'm on stage and the audience is with me, and you know, ideally it's when people are already familiar with the songs. I'm not like coming in going, hi, my name's Andrew, you've never heard me, but it's a room full of people who know the songs already, and we can experience them together kind of objectively without, it's like I'm not a part of it. It's like the song is the thing then. And that is just one of the best feelings in the world. The feeling of connection, of looking out and seeing people moved to either joy or, you know, sadness by your own story is just a giant affirmation that the Lord uses art to connect us.
So you're a Christian artist who grew up in a subculture that really didn't understand the arts and didn't understand
I music. Would say so.
You're the father of artistic offspring. Talk to us a little bit about how those of us who care about Christians in the arts can encourage artists, how we could, our own children, grandchildren, but in the church.
Well, I just think we try in our, all I can tell you is about how we do it in our house. Like we from a very young age, I helped, I exposed the kids to music that wasn't by Christians, just because I would rather them listen to a good song by somebody who's not a Christian than a really bad song by somebody who is. And so to try to cultivate in them a little bit of like healthy snobbery about what good music is, and to look at the way the Lord uses that. And so I remember from a very young age, like playing Counting Crows for my kids, like one of my favorite bands in college. And, you know, they tend to want to know what the songwriter believes. Like as little children, they'd be 6 years old and they'd hear a song and be like, is that guy a Christian? Like, what is he singing about here? And we would cultivate a habit of asking questions about where the art came from, what it might mean. And I think that's the thing, is we just, you know, and even now my kids don't think of there being a hard divide between Christian music and secular music. They're just on the hunt for something beautiful. And so as far as them playing music, we just leave instruments out. We didn't really force them to take lessons. I just would leave guitars in their bedrooms at night, you know, and they gravitated to it.
So if you were to give advice to, I'll say pastors and church leaders about how to encourage the arts in their communities, what would you say to them?
Well, I think just off the cuff, I think, you know, there's this thing that, like, in the movie business, where, you know, they try to market movies to Christian audiences, you know, like The Shack is coming out, whatever.
Yep. And I've been in the midst of those. I know what that's
and
like.
And I've never read the book.
Yeah.
But I know enough about it to be kind of like a little eye-rolly.
Right.
And, but then a movie like Silence came out. That I have friends who say that it's their favorite book. It's a very difficult book, but it's also a probing and deep and honest book, you know. And one movie that was Silence, arguably a very Christian movie, flopped. Selma, like in many ways, a very Christian movie, flopped. But then the church just gravitates to these other things. But the truth of it is that, like, the Christians that they're trying to market all these other movies to are really just watching Netflix. They're watching mainstream movies at home. And I think a lot of pastors are doing the same thing, you know? And so we have almost this shame, like, we're not really supposed to be watching this thing or listening to that band or whatever. And how many times have, you know, I remember even as a kid being so excited when my dad would mention, like, Indiana Jones from the pulpit and just say, like, okay, remember that scene in whatever when this happened, as a way of illustrating? And it's not like, you know, pastors have to use movies, but, like, to integrate the like who we are as. So let me say one more. I'm getting off topic, but I was read this fat interesting article in Entertainment Weekly on a plane or something, where this guy was talking about Netflix, and this was back before it was streaming. It was all DVDs that would come to your house, and he said he was talking about how many times he would, like, order movies, and then they would show up at his house, and he would be like, what was I thinking? I don't really want to watch this. And he would mail it back. And he said he realized that there was the movie watcher he wishes he was, and then there's the movie watcher he actually is. Like, he wishes he watched art house films, but really he just wants to watch Taken 3, you know, or whatever.
Right.
And so I think it's like, there's a part of me that's like, let's just own up to the fact that we are experiencing these things in this way and see how the gospel speaks to us in it. And the other thing I would say is that Frederick Buechner had a huge influence on me. Our church is actually reading Telling Secrets, church book club that we're doing. And I've been reminded reading that book how beautiful it is that the way Buechner talks about how important it is for ministers to be honest with their own stories.
That's actually going to be my next question, is I'm hearing a tone of honesty. Let's be honest about life.
That
I'm hearing you consistently push at. And I sometimes think the church is guilty of covering over the hard parts and the tensions of life. And therefore, there's a disconnect between the reality of the tension people feel in life versus the way the church talks about what they feel. And
there's a supposed to.
And versus the way I may be really feeling, or the way I'm really processing what's going on, that kind of thing. And I do think that good art has the ability to expose that, I think that's the right word too, to expose that, and all of a sudden it confronts you in a way in which you go, I can't turn away. You know, I've got to face up to this thing that's been put in front of me and actually interact with it. I can't shut it off; it's too powerful, etc. And that's some of the strength of art when we keep our eyes open for it and are willing to walk into those spaces.
And there are a lot of Christian artists who are doing that and doing it well.
Exactly, that
piece you wrote in response to Bono's comment to Peterson.
Yeah,
that thing exploded.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of artists who are telling the truth, who are doing that well.
Yeah. You could say the same thing about filmmakers too. And there's so many people working really hard. There's a guy in Nashville he's a film marketer, Eric Loxamo, and a really nice guy, but his job is to try to find a way to get Christians to watch movies that kind of fall in the middle, where they're like too Christian for the mainstream, but too not safe enough for the typical Christian audience. And it's just, to me, I'm like, oh man, why isn't the church embracing these things? It's so hard to make a movie that when a movie comes out that is honest in that way, like, man, support it. You know, mm-hmm. it's good. It's telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Talk, if you would, for a couple of minutes about the transition now of Wing Feather to film.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. What a fun thing. Mm-hmm. I can be really brief. But the Wing Feather saga is this four-book big fantasy adventure story mm-hmm. that I usually describe as being a cross between Princess Bride and Lord of the Rings. So it's big and epic, but it also, you know, is a little bit fun mm-hmm. at times. And so anyway, I for years have thought, you know, the kids will ask, when are you going to make a movie? Mm-hmm. And I just can't ever imagine somebody giving me the $5 million it would take. Not me, but putting up
and
the
$5 million. That's not that much for a movie.
Right. And then it would be really bad and dumb. Yeah. But then because of the fact that I think we're living in like the golden age of television, mm-hmm. where like the some of the best storytellers have gravitated to that mm-hmm. serial television thing because mm-hmm. they have this freedom and the time to expand the world and mm-hmm. build a character and follow them. I was like, what if there was a Netflix four season show that was mm-hmm. Wing Feather Saga season 1, 2, 3, and 4 that so we could really tell the story, which is ultimately a story about resurrection. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I pitched it to a buddy of mine, and he's a producer. I met him at VeggieTales, and mm-hmm. he was done with VeggieTales and looking for a project. And I was mm-hmm. like, what if we were to make a Wing Feather Saga mm-hmm. pilot and mm-hmm. pitch to Netflix? So that's what we're doing. We're mm-hmm. making a kind of a proof of concept pilot that we raised money for on Kickstarter. And if we can get in through the door, we're going to say, hey, you guys, let us make this movie.
Oh, wow. So that sounds pretty cool. Mm. Well, flown by. I mean.
We didn't even get to beekeeping yet.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we'll save the bees for another story. Okay. But anyway, I really appreciate your willingness to come in and talk with us about the arts a little bit. Hopefully this has been an encouragement and a stimulation to people about thinking about the way in which we can be touched and impacted by God and the way we see the world and reality. I sometimes think that some of the most powerful illustrations I get are the words that people have written for lyrics and that kind of thing that open up a conversation and that distill certain things that are going on in life in such a packaged way that you end up in a space that you might not otherwise occupy. And so I do appreciate your willingness to come in and interact with us on this.
Thanks for having me.
And also for you, Glenn, I think some people will go, that guy teaches systematic theology at Dallas Seminary? Yeah, he does.
He does.
Yeah, so.
And he wants to be a songwriter.
We're waiting.
So we thank you for being a part of the table and hope you'll join us again soon. And we hope this has been an opportunity to really reflect on where God has you.
Thanks for listening to the Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.